Hello and welcome to the Providence College Podcast. My name is Joe Carr. Our guest today is Dr. Hugh Lina, Providence College's Senior Vice President for Academic Affairs and Provost. A PC mainstay for more than four decades, Dr. Lina has had a front row seat for a period of dramatic transformation, and his own impact has been immeasurable. He joined the PC Sociology faculty in 1974 and has served with distinction as a scholar, mentor, role model, and leader. His service as provost, which roughly coincides with Father Brian Shanley's presidency, is notable for stellar additions to the faculty, for the deepened integration of research into the PC academic program, and for any number of decisions that have served to raise the college's stature as a premier Catholic liberal arts institution. Hugh, thank you for taking the time to join us today. Let's start by talking about the current situation as the world deals with coronavirus and COVID-19. What are some of your observations on the way the faculty and staff have stepped up to make this work under these circumstances?
Yes, it's been a remarkable transformation. I would say, with only a little bit of exaggeration, that the faculty moved heaven and earth in order to make this happen. Most institutions of higher education gave their faculty a week or 2 weeks to prepare for a transition to remote learning. We gave our faculty only 2 days. And so it was really remarkable that they were able to step up and move to a remote instructional process within a very short period of time. Overall, we've been monitoring the progress that our students have made and our faculty have made during this time, and I think it's just really remarkable that we've been able to maintain the quality of our academic experience during this time of difficulty.
And during those 2 days, the college really had to tap the expertise and creativity and energy of its professional staff in academic affairs, too. Some thoughts on the people who made this work in terms of providing the technology and how to make it all effective?
Yes, no question about it. I mean, we had the technology expertise and we had the facilities and infrastructure to make it happen, but it wasn't something that most of our faculty used on an extensive basis. And so the support that's been provided by all of the IT staff, the instructional technology people, the staff in the administrative offices has all been remarkable. And we have, over the course of the time of this COVID crisis, as an office, sent out 39 different messages providing our faculty with resources that are available to them to make this educational experience have the value that we want. And it's been very, very helpful to have all of that support behind us.
Does anything stand out in terms of what you have seen, significant challenges that had to be addressed and how they might have been managed?
Yeah, one of the most remarkable things that I think has happened is that the faculty generally, when they're teaching in person, are focused on the content of what they're teaching. And what this experience has done for a lot of our faculty is get them to think about how to focus on student learning rather than just the content. We learned very early on that the faculty had a tendency to overwork the students by just adding on more assignments and more time, synchronous as well as asynchronous time. But over time, over the experience, the faculty have adjusted to recognizing that what really counts here is what the student learning is, what's happening with student learning, rather than making sure that they deliver the content that's in their syllabus.
And because of the scope of this crisis, the planning and adjusting has never stopped and really hardly ever slowed down. We're still, as we move into May, in the midst of with your team continuing to plan and tweak and look at various scenarios, it's now part of the day to day, and it looks like it will continue that way for the foreseeable future, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. I mean, I don't really like the expression "the new normal," but there's no question but that the way we're going to go about ensuring the value of a Providence College degree is going to be different in the future. My team has been meeting 3 and 4 times a week just with me. Now what we're involved in is conversations with the other divisions and with the officials at other colleges and universities in Rhode Island, as well as the state government, to figure out how we're going to plan effectively for the future. My mantra all the time that I've been here at the college is that we work very hard here to improve the value of a student's degree as time goes on. And I still believe firmly that we're able to do that in this time of crisis.
Mentioned at the beginning that you are a sociologist. So how does a sociologist who has become provost consider these challenges, and how does that affect the ways that you manage your responsibilities?
Joe, I can't tell you how much I appreciate that question because I haven't acted as a sociologist in quite a while, but I do believe that the discipline that I was trained in is extremely helpful in these kinds of times. The discipline of sociology has a long tradition of studying the nature of social organization in crisis situations. When there's a major flood or an earthquake or Three Mile Island, social disorganization often sets in. And so, although I'm not a disaster specialist, clearly my training in how to understand and move through periods of crisis has been helpful. I think probably one of the most important things that I've learned is that the culture that we live within and the values and norms that we follow on an everyday basis continue to operate in times of crisis. And if we can rely on that confidence that we trust in tradition and values and norms, then it really helps a lot.
Well, I should say that all of us who care about Providence College are grateful that you are in a leadership position at this time, and really thankful for all that you and all of your colleagues are doing to help make this work, while also keeping an eye on the future and the college's continuing aspirations to grow and to thrive. So this is certainly a test, that's for sure.
One of the things I said to my staff when I first moved into a full-time administration was that we were encountering not problems, but opportunities. And I continue to be optimistic that what we learned through this experience represents for us, for the most part, an opportunity, not a problem.
Oh, that is good to hear. Thank you for saying that. So let's talk more about you. To place this in time, I hope you all mind, you joined the faculty a few weeks after Richard Nixon resigned. So in 1974, a while back, what was Providence College like when you joined the faculty?
If I could just go back just a little bit in time and tell you my story about my arrival here. I graduated from college 50 years ago this year, and my last semester in my undergraduate school was marred at the end by the killings of students at Kent State University, which was 50 years ago last week. As a result of that, there was a national student strike. Classes were canceled, students had to deal with pass-fail grades, and commencements were disrupted. Here I find myself at the end of my career here at Providence College 50 years later, experiencing deja vu all over again, with classes in their normal sense canceled, students taking pass-fail, and no commencement on time. The aftermath of the 1970 disruption on college campuses was still present when I arrived on campus, although the concern about the draft for the Vietnam War, the student unrest was certainly much dissipated at that point in time, but there were still remnants of it. I can remember the first faculty senate meeting I went to. The senate met in the Aquinas Lounge. And it was my first experience with a lot of my colleagues in a public setting. And most of the meeting was a debate about whether at commencement, the honor guard should wear silver helmets that look like General Patton. There was a lot of objection on the part of student demonstrators at that point in time to eliminate the so-called military-industrial complex. And I thought, such an august body of the faculty senate is going to spend all of its time talking about helmets? Very surprising.
There has been a little bit of discussion among some people we've been around in recent weeks about those days. And in this context, it's actually a specific person, our friend Bill Hudson, the political science professor who has been a guest on this podcast and who has his own, arrived around the same time. And you were in the same office building, Howley Hall. Is that correct? That story hold true?
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, my first day of teaching, which was in Guzman Hall, I'm standing outside waiting for my 8:30 class to begin. And there's this gentleman in a three-piece suit standing, waiting for to teach in the room next to me. I had bell bottoms on and hair on my shoulders, and Bill had a suit on. And I thought, this is interesting. Bill and I not only started at the same time, we started teaching on the same day, and we taught in very close proximity to one another. And here it is now. We're getting recognized in our service recognition system for 45 years of service here.
And stellar service at that in each case. Classes in Guzman Hall, some of us remember that. Those the classrooms down there, so sure, near where the chapel was. So
the other thing that I would, yes, the Guzman Chapel was, you know, an important place for students, as well as the Aquinas Chapel, both of which now have moved on to another form. The other thing that was really important about my arrival here was that it was the first year when women had been students for full 4 years at the college. And at that time, there were about 2,000 undergraduates, and there was a significant amount of conversation about the arrival of women, in this case, getting degrees from the school. They weren't the first people to get PC degrees who were women, but there was a lot of conversation about gender at that time, not just at PC, but many single-sex schools at that point, for survival reasons, if nothing else, were becoming co-ed.
It's safe to assume the acclimation was continuing, and it was only about, as you indicated, 4 years into the period of time after women had become students here?
Absolutely. The acclimation for the most of the male faculty was, I think, pretty easy, most of whom came from co-ed institutions. There were very few at the time women on the faculty. The adjustment for them was really quite different. Just a couple of interesting pieces. The first tenured woman faculty member at the college was Father Shanley's mother. She was a librarian at the time, known for being a stern protector of library resources and all of the rules in a library. But there were a few other women faculty members who had just started with me, who were fighting very hard to get recognition from the male faculty and also from the male students. So it was an interesting time.
Incidentally, just to backtrack slightly, you mentioned a short time ago your time as an undergraduate student. I'd like to point out that that was at Notre Dame, and there's a reason for that, because we're going to come back to Notre Dame toward the end. Of course, sure. Who were some of the faculty and or Dominican and or Dominican faculty role models you looked up to in those early days?
I'll sound like I'm reminiscing to the old times now. The faculty who were so important to me, the list is quite long. Richard Grace and Mario D'Annunzio, who are still here teaching, were extraordinary role models for me in terms of faculty governance and legislation. I was much impressed by former directors of the Honors Program, Rodney Della Santa. Rene Fortin was really a well-known person on campus. But probably the person who had the greatest influence on me was the then academic vice president. His name was Paul Van K. Thompson. Very impressive character, a degree from Columbia. He was extremely knowledgeable, was a wonderful commencement speaker, had a deep, sonorous voice, and he was a great supporter, not just of me, but of the growing number of faculty he was hiring to improve the quality of faculty. I would say he's solely responsible for the creation of the Honors Program. He had the wisdom to create the psychology program at the time. And so from the lay faculty point of view, I had a lot of role models. Similarly, the Dominicans represented a very important force in my life. Father Cosgren, Father Cunningham, who then became president later, Father Hunt, who was an art historian. Father Hunt was an impressive character. He wore engineering boots. Some people know them as big black boots with a silver buckle on the side. They were size 14. And Father Hunt came to me one day and said, "Lena, your name's Lena. You're Italian." I said, no, actually, I'm Irish. My family changed its name when they immigrated to the United States." He said, "No, you've got to be Italian." And I said, "No, Father, I don't want to be disrespectful, but I'm Irish." And he said, "Well, your family must have lived in Italy at some point in time."
He wasn't giving up on that, huh? So
he wasn't giving up. And that was, they were iconoclastic Dominicans at the time. Some of us know about the Colonel Del Corso, who rode around his campus. You're shaking your head, Joe. I know you know who I'm talking about.
Well, we were all scared of him. Yes.
Yes. So he rode around his bike like the Wicked Witch on the West and cracked down on students who were misbehaving. Father Peterson, who became president, was an important role model for me. Father Lennon was very important. Father Reed, the Fathers Kenny, there were two people in the philosophy department who were brothers. So a lot of really fond memories of the importance of both lay and Dominican faculty in my formation as a faculty member.
It's interesting. The first five you mentioned all have spaces named for them in the Ruane Center for the Humanities. And you mentioned Dr. Thompson being responsible to a large extent for the formation of the honors program. But those are also, to some extent, the people who stood up the development of a Western civilization program starting in 1971, which persists today as the centerpiece of the academic enterprise that you oversee.
That's correct. No question about it. And at that time, when I came in 74, we were still kind of tweaking that system. It was a fairly controversial move at that point to cut down on the number of philosophy and theology courses and to think about a creative way of introducing our students to interdisciplinary inquiry around the history of Western civilization.
In the interest of time, I'd like to jump over a bunch of years and bring up closer to the present. Father Shanley is finishing his 15th year as president, and for almost all of that time, you have been the provost. So most people probably know this who are listening, but the provost oversees the academic program, and the academic program in virtually any institution, and certainly in this one, is the largest part of the enterprise. And so much has happened. Could you ever have imagined the dramatic changes that we've seen at Providence College in the past 15 years or even the past six or seven?
No. I mean, we have been blessed with the opportunity to hire over 60% of our faculty during that time. They're remarkable in terms of both their scholarly achievements, but also as important to me is their willingness to do what I call hand-to-hand combat with students. Senior faculty be willing to teach introductory level courses. They're available for students. They're really committed to being teacher scholars. And that's been remarkable. I certainly didn't anticipate the growth in academic buildings. You know, one of the things that Father Shanley always mentions is that buildings are really in and of themselves not important. It's the people that are important. But what we've done here is use the people to create spaces where they can profit and they can flourish. And from an educational point of view, from a pedagogical point of view, the interplay between the structures that we build and the way that we go about our teaching and learning are married in a very wonderful way. So that's been remarkable and unanticipated by me.
What is it that has fueled all this progress?
Well, I think at its heart is the Dominican commitment to pursuing truth. I mean, that sounds like a cliche, but for me, it's not. I think that there's always been a desire on the part of people committed to the PC mission that we continue to improve. In some ways, it's like what I would call the Rhode Island syndrome. We kind of see ourselves or saw ourselves in the past as the little guy. And so the striving to not be the underdog and to improve has always been an important driving force at the college, in my opinion. And now that we're at a point where we're a hot school right now and we're very competitive, I think it's even more exciting that the strategic plan is going to allow us to make the next jump.
And so much support from alumni who, say, alumni from the 40s and 50s who came into their careers and recognized the value that their PC education had been to contributing to their success, and then they have become involved in so many ways and really helping to make the progress continue and happen in the first place.
Yeah, the alumni have been an important force in the experience of our students, not only while they're here, but after they graduate. the way that I think about it is, it's really exciting to see children of former students come into your class and talk about the effect that the impact that the college has had on their educational experience. Interesting enough for me, I guess I've been here long enough to know that that it shouldn't be surprising to me that several members of the Board of Trustees were former students of mine, and some faculty too, senior faculty. But the alumni represent for Providence College a force of support that is often unrecognized, but is really an important part of our success in what we do here.
That's for sure. Well said. Nicely said. You mentioned that you and Father Shanley have hired about 60% or so of the current faculty. How would you describe the type of new professor who is joining Providence College in this era?
Yeah. Well, I would say compared to when I first was hired, the faculty we hire now come in with more experience. Their entry into a career in the collegium is a little bit delayed because they often take postdocs, or they've had another career in between to get some so-called real-world experience. When I came here, it was not uncommon for faculty to have come right out of graduate school after 5 years. And now it's uncommon for us to hire faculty under the age of 30. They come with postdoc experience and a significant, scholarly background. And I think they come with teaching experience. It wasn't the case when I was in graduate school. There were much opportunities for graduate students to be instructed in pedagogy. Now, very often we'll see faculty come with experience not only teaching, but having been formally trained in pedagogy. And some even take postdocs in pedagogy and in teaching at liberal arts colleges. I would say that the faculty that we bring in now are really committed to engaging with students in important matters. They're much more interested in doing research with students than was the case many years ago. And I think that they are really committed to improving the value of the degree that we offer.
I'd like to pick up on that notion of research and how it involves the students. How has the evolving nature of academic research affected what happens in the PC classrooms and laboratories?
It's really been important that our faculty recognize that hands-on experience, signature work, engaged learning is an important part of what we offer here at the college. We know from the research that students remember more and learn more when they can use their hands, if you want to call it that, in their learning. And the faculty are committed to engaging students with them in the inquiry, contributing to the knowledge base. One of the things that has made that easier here than at some institutions is that I think we've recognized that research that faculty do with students is research. It's valuable. It should be acknowledged and rewarded. The traditional view of academic scholarship is that it has to be done by a faculty member with a lot of expertise, addressed to a very esoteric audience. And the loosening up of our understanding of how knowledge can be created has really been helpful to our commitment to undergraduate research.
And this is not to suggest that research is something new in scholarship. Back to your career a bit, what are your research interests? What kinds of things have you explored in the field of sociology?
Yeah, I started off, my dissertation was an organizational study of hospitals, but I got interested in the course of my graduate school career in the field of medical sociology or health sociology. And so I did a fair amount of work on child abuse just as when I was coming into the college. In the early 80s, I became very interested in the epidemic. It reminds me now of what was going on then, the epidemic of HIV/AIDS. So I started teaching in that area and doing volunteer work. I was interested all through that process in how we came to understand from a conceptual point of view, what does it mean to be in an epidemic? What is a pandemic and how different from an epidemic is it? Who's at risk? How do we deal with the fact that our lives are changed as a result of a diagnosis? Again, these are all contemporary issues with respect to the pandemic of COVID-19. Subsequent to that, I got deeply interested in the idea of community-based service. Probably one of the most formative experiences I had was in 1994 to 95. I was on the research and development team that created the Feinstein Institute and the Public and Community Service Studies major. It was at the time then that I was still doing work on HIV and AIDS, and I was able to combine my personal commitment to dealing with that pandemic with my interest in thinking about how we can better educate students around community service and reflection and so on. And the years that I've spent working on the program there and thinking about how to change my teaching in as a result have been important, not only to my teaching, but also to the scholarship that I did. Just before I moved into full-time administration, my interests shifted to global health. And I was looking at political and economic factors that influence how countries can provide basic needs to their population. At that point, I was interested in making a distinction between what does it mean to devote resources to healthcare as opposed to devoting resources to medical care. At the time, thinking that countries are often better off and their quality of health is much better if they invest more in basic needs like education, sanitation, poverty, than if they invest in more hospitals and doctors.
Fascinating stuff, and the connections to real world issues today are very interesting. Like Father Shanley, you also continue to teach. Can you tell us a little more about that and why it's important to you and what you get from it?
Well, Joe, the simplest answer to your question is I was hired to teach. I don't think that what I do now is not teaching, but there's something about the energy that young people bring to an educational experience that's, you know, just exciting. I used to say that each semester is like a new job, a new set of challenges with new people who are excited to learn with you. I've really benefited in the last 15 years by teaching in the honors program, small classes with really, really smart students. And while I haven't taught quite as much as Father Shanley because of the amount of responsibility in my job, I've really enjoyed it. I do joke with Father Shanley that I can't afford the time to teach, whereas I think he can. So that means my job's harder than his. It's a joke.
I understood. We took it that way. What are your observations of the students of today? And what is their potential for affecting change and progress in society?
I think it's enormous. I mean, my contact with our Providence College students is a bit limited. I do have a student advisory council, and my top leadership team meets with them 3 or 4 times a year just to learn what's going on the streets. And this semester, while the COVID crisis has changed their lives dramatically, in speaking with them, I've been impressed with not only their ability to make the adjustment that faculty asked them to make, but the success that they've had in learning during this period. So, you know, I think the students are highly motivated to be successful, maybe not quite as idealistic and committed to community-based services, perhaps it was 25 years ago or so, but nonetheless still civic-minded and really committed to the institution. They love it here.
Let's talk a little bit about your family and about yourself. You you have a wonderful family. We see your wife, Sue, is around all the time and a friend to a great many at Providence College. So tell us about the family.
Sure. Sue and I met on a blind date in our senior year in college and got married about 5 months later. Our deal was that for 4 years she'd work and I'd get my PhD, and then she could do anything she wanted and I would work for at least 4 years. She did get her master's degree here at PC in education and taught for many years at fifth grade, and then became an elementary school head at a private girls' school here in the city. She decided to retire a few years ago, but she's still doing tutoring, mostly on a volunteer basis, and doing quite well. That the decision that she made after 4 years was to have a child, and in fact, when I moved here to Providence College, the first semester I had to finish my dissertation, I had 3 new course preparations, and I had a new baby. That new baby is, I didn't anticipate this, but she became a sociologist, got her PhD at Columbia, and now, in fact, is an associate professor with tenure at Teachers College Columbia. She's a sociologist, as I said, but she's interested in culture. And in this past semester, she's actually published two books. One, her second book with Princeton University Press, and her third book is with Stanford University Press. She travels around the world a lot to lecture on her topic. She's interested in how culture change takes place and how elites control the production of culture. It's, for the most part, when I talk to her, a topic that I don't understand very well. It is very pleasing that she is a sociologist. There aren't very many father-daughter teams in the discipline of sociology. If I could tell you one quick story, she and I did some work together when she was in graduate school, and we were delivering a paper in Toronto. And it said Jennifer C. Lena, Columbia University, and Hugh F. Lena, Providence College. And as she started to talk and give the presentation, I noticed that the people in our panel were not even paying attention to what she was saying, at least I could imagine. They were trying to figure out what our relationship was. And so I finally stopped her about 2 minutes, 3 minutes into the talk. And I said, look, here's the deal. We're not married to one another, which, you know, in my discipline is sometimes a possibility. I said, I'm the father. I'm at a small Catholic school in the Northeast. She's my daughter. She's at an Ivy League university. And once I had said that, then it was fine. They paid attention to what we had to say.
Now that we've got that straight, we can move on. Right. So
so that's the family.
That's great.
We're all doing well. We're staying healthy. My daughter has decided that she's worried that I come into the office every day. So she's sending me Blue Apron meals so that I'm thinking that it'll keep me home.
Very nice. A good thought. That's for sure. You travel quite a bit, you and Sue. What is it that you enjoy about travel and what do you gain from it?
Yeah. When I was growing up, my father was only home with the family. I had five siblings, a half an hour a day. He didn't get a chance to travel much, although he did do a trip in 1962 to Africa. He was on a traditional safari.
He was a physician, right?
He was a physician, a surgeon, and stopped on the way and got an honorary certificate or something like that from the Pope. But anyway, he never got a chance to travel. And so when my mother passed away, it was an opportunity for him as he was winding down his surgical career to travel. And he wanted to travel with someone who knew how to travel. So I consider that my interest in travel came from my desire to learn with him, to be educated alongside him, because he spent so little time with me when I was growing up. And so, for me, travel is an educational experience. I take a log every time I travel, writing down what I've learned, and that's been an important part of the relaxation now that my wife forces me to have. But it's about education. Well, the most recent trip we made was to the Mediterranean. We went along the Adriatic coast. We had a trip planned in March this year. We were going to go to the Big East, which we did, and then we left when the game was canceled. We were going to go to Abu Dhabi, where my daughter was going to give a talk on her book, and then to Istanbul for 4 days for a vacation, and then go to Berlin, where my daughter teaches four times a year at a university there. And of course, the COVID-19 pandemic, especially over in Europe at that point, did not allow us to take that trip. I would have loved to have gone back to Istanbul. I was there for 3 years in a row for short stints to teach. The Istanbul itself is just a fabulous city filled with history and a great educational experience. And so I'm hoping that sometime I can go back there. Right now, we have a trip planned. We planned it quite a while ago to go from London to Copenhagen and then to Iceland in July. But I think it's increasingly looking like we're not going to be making that trip. And to give you a little bit of insight into my wife and her connection with the college, she's been more than happy to go to the president and say, after I retire, that I'd be willing to go around to all of the places in the world where our students study and do a report and give it to him. And she, of course, would come along with me, and naturally the college would pay for her travels.
What a thoughtful gesture.
Indeed. So,
and another interest that you have that we share is sports. And this brings us back to Notre Dame. It seems like at least once a year you make your way to South Bend for a football game. Is that about right?
I do. I like college football, and particularly follow Notre Dame. I like to watch the games by myself, though. I don't like to be very public about my anger. And I do believe that in some seasons, Notre Dame owes me my hypertension medication. But the first day I came on the Notre Dame campus, I never visited before, the day I moved in, the first student I saw was, it turns out, a classmate of mine. He was walking down the quad. He was 6'7", 276 pounds. Turned out my classmate was Mike McCoy, who was an All-American at Notre Dame. We were national champions our first year. And Mike went on to play for, I think, 14 or 16 years with the Green Bay Packers. Another guy who was a year ahead of me, but pretty close to, Alan Page, went on to play for the Minnesota Vikings and was a judge for many years. So I got interested in football while I was there, but didn't go to a game until 1992. And I was moving my daughter into her college room. She also, by the way, never saw her campus before we dropped her off. And I was introduced to her roommate's father, who turns out was a classmate of mine at Notre Dame and a doctor in Boston. And he had season tickets that he got because he made big donations to the college, to the university. He said, if you ever want to go to a game, I'll give you tickets. I said, I'd love to go to a game. So I got tickets for the first game between Boston College and Notre Dame out in South Bend. Thankfully, it was a great win for Notre Dame. But the interesting part about that game was that that's the game at which they filmed the movie Rudy. And so I believe that I'm in the movie Rudy. Of course, you can't see me, but you can hear perhaps all of us saying, Rudy, Rudy.
Right. Plenty of big crowd shots in that. So we'll look closely for you next time that rolls by.
And the other thing we share, Joe, is an interest in hockey.
That's for sure.
A couple of hockey players in class when I first came here, and they gave me tickets. I didn't understand the rules, so we got season tickets so we could learn more about hockey. And I've became great friends with a lot of great players, starting with the Wilson brothers at Providence College. And
good place to start.
Yeah, Randy Velichek and Robbie Goudreau and Brian Burke was a pretty close friend. Tim Army, I had in class. And I was able to go to the final game that PC played against RPI in 1982. And then even more exciting at the national championship game that we won with BU a few years ago.
Randy Velichek was my classmate. So nice to hear that name. What a player and a great, great student, by the way. That's for sure. I would not mean to suggest by the focus on Notre Dame that you're anything but an excellent Friar fan across all sports.
Nowadays, I wear the Providence College clothing outside of my Notre Dame clothing when the two teams play.
Perfect. That's an excellent solution, I think. So that's all good. So at the end of this academic year, you'll be stepping down from this role as provost. What are you planning for the future, and what are your hopes for Providence College's future?
Well, I've applied for a fellowship at Notre Dame. It's called the Inspired Leadership Initiative. This would be the third year they've had the program. They accept about 15 fellows. And it's an opportunity to spend a year in reading and reflection and discussions about what the next phase of your career is going to be. And so I'm going to spend the year at Notre Dame, hopefully, learning more. Educating myself, offering my assistance to the students and faculty there. I can take any course at the university that I want. And then my hope is to come back here to Providence College and teach maybe a course a year and do volunteer work. So I'm looking very much forward to immersing myself in an educational experience for a year. My hope is that the trajectory that Father Shanley and I have been working very hard on. It's not a hope. It's a knowledge that we know will happen, that trajectory will continue. I see nothing but opportunity for the college. And so I'm very, very optimistic and hopeful about the future. I know Father Sicard very well, and I know that he has in mind great things for the college. And with the extraordinary talent that exists at all levels of this college and continued improvement in the quality of the faculty and students we bring in, this is more than achievable.
Nicely said. It's good to hear that from your perspective. We've wanted to have you on the podcast for quite a while, Hugh, but then we started talking about timing and picked this week intentionally because it is the Monday before what would have been commencement. Certainly something that's important to you. You have been our master of ceremonies at commencement for a great many years. And when we look at the impact of this terrible situation, lots of things come to mind, but it is striking in the context of any educational institution what a tough blow this is for seniors, high school or college seniors, to miss that, isn't it? And what are you thinking about, and what are you thinking about with respect to those students these days?
We're seeing a lot of this in the media as well. I know how important for students this final commencement is. It's very, very disappointing to them to not have the full experience. I think that probably it's going to be unfortunate that it will never be the experience that that they would have hoped for in the past, but it still represents a milestone for them, and we will find ways, I think, for them to be acknowledged in their achievements. For me personally, it would have been nice to have one last commencement. As you probably know, I was getting a honorary degree, and I was looking forward to that. That's a wonderful honor. So in a sense, I feel some sympathy with the experience that students have. But I've said to a few students that I've talked to that I went through a similar experience 50 years ago. And while there were things that I missed, we made a great opportunity out of it. And I'll always remember the time that I had as an undergraduate, despite the fact that the commencement was not what I had hoped for.
Well, we will certainly look forward to the day when that honorary degree is conferred. As of now, the plan is for it to be October 31st. We hope that will happen, but the day will come, and it will be a red letter day for Providence College, because we all appreciate you for all that you've done for the college and for those of us who know you. I know every time I see you on campus, I end up walking away with a smile. So I appreciate that, and a lot of people feel the same way.
Thank you, Joe. That means a lot to me. You're a special friend.
We appreciate your time, Hugh, today. This has been a lot of fun, and good luck working your way through this period with you and your family and your work, and we'll hope to see you around soon.
All right. Thank you very much, Joe.
And thank you for joining us today. You can subscribe to the Providence College podcast at all the usual places, and they're available on the college's YouTube channel. Feedback is welcome at podcast@providence.edu. Thanks to our producer, Chris Judge. I'm Joe Carr. Until next time.